Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. No Place Like the Morgue, story number one. My name is Carl, and I'm an urban explorer. For years, one of my favorite hobbies has been exploring abandoned buildings. I love the thrill of breaking into some place you're not supposed to be, the sense of wonder and mystery, the beauty of nature reclaiming the masonry. Each adventure felt like I was in some long abandoned ruin, finding the treasures of the culture that lived there before. I couldn't tell you when or how I got into the hobby, but I know that it probably started with the Knight Hospital, an asylum for the mentally retarded. That's their words. Just a mile from my house, closed many years before I was born. In a small college town, stories and legends of the hospital were spoken with hushed whispers on schoolyards of how it was shut down for extreme malpractice and patient abuse, or how you could find stacks of aged reports about bizarre experiments. And of course, there were dozens and dozens of claims of hauntings. But lest any child think of exploring on their own, the stories would always end with one ominous warning: never, ever go into the morgue. Living so close, I had the opportunity to check out the hospital many times over my childhood. The dusty, crumbling quarters and peeling paint eventually felt like a second home to me, despite constant police patrols and decades worth of vandalism. Over the years, I managed to create a pretty sizable collection of photographs and mementos. I became familiar with every nook and cranny, every hallway and staircase. I came up with nicknames for the various rooms. The dentist's office was the one with the decrepit x-ray machine, right next to the blue room, a recessed office with painted windows that bathed the room in an eerie blue light. Downstairs lay the crypt, a dirt floor basement adjacent to the boiler. After spending so much time in the building, I had my doubts about its haunted status. I heard noises every now and then, a creaking door, muffled footsteps. But being the skeptic that I am, I always dismissed these as a trick of the mind. And if there were ghosts lurking in the shadows, at least they never caused me any harm. Still, no matter how far I explored or how rational my thought, I always remembered the warning: never, ever go into the morgue. I had never been near it. I had seen the door, though. Located down in the basement, the morgue door stood ominous, its paint faded and hinges rusting. Every time I walked by, I felt a deep temptation to grab the handle and slowly, carefully, just take a quick peek inside. It was, after all, the last uncharted corner of this vast ruin. And my curiosity almost got the better of me several times. But when I would extend my hand and gingerly reach for the door, I would be overwhelmed by a deep, inexplicable sense of dread. I tried to reason with it, tell myself it was only the stories giving this room a power over me, that it was only a room like all the others. Yet, I would find myself slowly backing away, some primal instinct warning me against my imagined dangers. I would not enter. But the morgue didn't care. It would wait, defiant, until the next time I felt like testing my courage. Last winter, everything changed. The snowy weather was giving me a terrible case of cabin fever, and looking for something to kill the tedium, I decided to visit the hospital for the first time in months. I packed my flashlight and crowbar and headed out the door. Strangely, I neglected to bring my camera with me, a decision that I now both regret and cherish. By the time I reached the hospital, the sun was just beginning to set. Breaking in had become something of a ritual by now, an adrenaline-building routine that I cherished almost as much as the exploration itself. I cached the crowbar by one of the boarded-up windows and did a quick walk around the building, checking for police or witnesses. Confident that I was alone, I returned to the window and began to pry at the plywood, eventually wrenching it loose with a loud crack. I threw the board and crowbar into the building and followed. Inside, the building seemed colder than ever, even for a late New England winter. I also could smell something new in the air, something strange and foreign that I hadn't recognized before, musky and distinctly unpleasant. As I moved deeper into the building, the scent grew in strength until I reached the basement stairs, and it nearly overpowered me. Every instinct in my body told me to leave, to not investigate further, but I didn't know better. I did not yet recognize the scent of death. As I crossed the basement door, I realized the smell was emanating from downstairs. Mustering up what little courage I still had, I slowly crept down the dark stairs, flicking on my flashlight as I reached the bottom landing. The scent was reaching into my throat now, and I could practically taste the rot in the air. I quickly scanned the room, and it didn't take long to spot the source. There, suspended by a beam in the center of the room, my light briefly caught a flash of clothing hanging off a vaguely humanoid form, swinging oh so slowly from a frayed length of extension cord. To say that I was terrified would have been an extreme understatement. I turned and ran, panic coursing through my veins, almost tripping over myself as I scrambled back up the stairs, trying to cough the scent of death out of my lungs. As I finally reached the top landing, I looked behind me, convinced that I would see the grim specter reaching for my ankles to drag me back down into its lair. Nothing came. My mind reeled, unsure of what I had seen. Of course, with the reputation of the building, I would have sworn that it was some kind of ghost, a specter of some former patient that had met a grim end and wanted nothing more than to devour my soul. But as I caught my breath, rationality slowly took hold. If it was some vengeful spirit, surely I would be dead already. Maybe I had imagined it, or perhaps some homeless vagrant had hung his wet clothes to dry. Contrary to every instinct to flee, I made the kind of decision that only a fool with too much courage could make. I had to take another look. My breath came in ragged gasps as I made my way back down the stairs again. The only thought echoing through my mind was how stupid I was being, that I should run for my life, and never return. But still, almost by their own accord, my legs carried me back until I was in the basement again, shrouded by the darkness. With a labored breath, I turned the light towards the figure again, fully expecting the next sight to be my last. There are two things every urban explorer dreads running into: the police and a dead body. The latter is a rare occurrence, but not unheard of. Murderers need places to stash their victims, and homeless men freeze to death. Every time I went into a new ruin, I ran the risk of discovering one. Slim as a chance may be, today my luck had run out. I stood frozen to the spot, eyes transfixed on the corpse in front of me. He had been there for, I assumed, a month or two, and the cold weather kept the body in fairly decent shape. There was some evidence of rot, most noticeably in his face, but I could still make out his slack, depressed expression. His clothes were filthy, but the grime was deep set, long before whatever circumstances brought him here. It was clearly a suicide, evidenced by a chair kicked not far from the body. Vaguely, I recalled a chair in one of my prior photographs of this room, and shivered at the realization that they were the same. Once I convinced myself that the man wasn't going to jump out and grab me, I moved in for a closer look. The letter. That damn letter. The one that brought all this upon me. I noticed it now on the ground before him, dangling just below his feet. A small, slightly yellowed piece of paper, carefully folded and placed before the body. I should have left then. Ignored what I saw, left everything, and tried to drown the memory in drink. But now, having seen it, it was too late. Looking back, maybe I didn't have any choice. Once I saw what was written on the front. "For Carl," it said. "My name." Written so simply, so elegantly, like a formal invitation. I guess really, that's what it was. I've seen enough horror movies and read enough stories to know what I did was stupid. But like I said, did I have a choice? I bent down and reached for the note carefully, like it was a loaded trap ready to ensnare me. And God help me, I opened it. The writing, jet black, was short and simple, but filled me with terror that I didn't know words could contain. Four simple words in child's handwriting. "We're waiting for you." As I read them, I heard a noise from above, a short gasp of expelled air, and the horrible creaking of old bones suddenly spurred into motion. I looked up, and I swear on my grave the corpse had moved. It was such a slight motion, just barely enough to notice, but now the head of the hangman faced down at me, his dead eyes locked directly into mine, staring through me and into my very soul. That was when I ran. I bolted up the stairs, note in hand, like all the hounds of hell were nipping at my heels. For all I knew, they very well could have been. My legs were fueled by pure, unadulterated fear, and I made it up the stairs in less than a blink. In no time, I had reached the window that was my entry point, and I all but dove through it into the welcoming snow outside. I didn't dare glance back until I had reached the main road, terrified of what might have followed me. Then, ungracefully, I proceeded to vomit. When I got home, I went to my neighbors and asked to use their phone. I called in an anonymous tip to the police about the body, but I never heard anything about it on the news. I comfort myself by saying that the papers didn't think a homeless suicide was worth reporting, but truthfully, my great fear was that when the police arrived, the body was gone. I fear this because for the next week, I would see it in my dreams. I could barely remember the dreams at first. They would be flashes of memory the morning after. Then, as my mind dismissed the fantasies, nothing. But by the third day, they were gaining strength, and there was no ignoring them. I would find the hangman sitting in the chair that I presumed he used, waiting for me. He still had all the appearance of a corpse, but he did not attempt to frighten me. Instead, he greeted me like an old friend, a rictus of a smile stretched across his rotten face. It didn't matter how cheery he tried to look, he still terrified me, and I would want to run, to put as many miles between us as possible. But in my dream, my body would refuse to obey, and I would walk towards him. As I drew close, he would usher me past, down the hall in the old hospital. Each time in the dream, I would walk further and further, never reaching my destination. But I could sense it, the absolute dread that only one place in the world could cause me, growing with each step. On the seventh night, my fears were confirmed. At the end of the hallway loomed the morgue. On the last night, I awoke in a sweat, mind addled, but my decision made. There was only one way to end the dreams, to appease the hangman. I dressed quickly and grabbed my flashlight and crowbar. That night, I walked towards the night hospital, like I had so many times before, not knowing if I would ever make the walk home again. The building loomed in the distance, as dark and foreboding as it was the first time I broke in as a child. Tonight, there would be no ritual, no safety checks for police or guardsmen. If anything, this time, I prayed they would stop me. I would not get so lucky. I entered through the same side window, still unboarded from the break-in prior. I made my way down the stairs into the basement, still expecting to see the corpse swaying from his beam or sitting in his chair as he had in my dreams. There was nothing. Only the pure and distinct sound of silence greeted me. Slowly, I made my way down the hall, fear and determination fighting against each other, wearing against me with each step. I could hear nothing but my footsteps and my own heartbeat pounding against my ribcage like it wanted to leap from my chest. Until finally in the darkness, it stood before me, just out of arm's reach, the door that guarded the morgue. Then, without warning, my flashlight flickered and died, leaving me in darkness more absolute and terrible than I could have imagined. Darkness and silence, then finally a sound. The door opened. Story number two. I'll say it right now. I grew up in a broken home. Dad drank. Mom drank. That might be why I've never touched a drop, but I'm getting on a tangent here. Most of you already know where this story is going. Dad used to get drunk and blame Mom and I for all his problems. Mom used to lock me in my room while you knock what aggressive drunks do when they're upset. I'd say more often than not, my mother's screams and my own sobs were what rocked me to sleep. Then my mom started drinking and became numb to the whole thing. First, Dad kept hitting her and left me to cry in my room. I guess he got bored eventually. 3 days after my 5th birthday, Dad came up to my room for the first time. He had never done that before. Mom had stopped him. He broke my nose that first night. We went to the hospital and I told the doctor I fell down the stairs. He seemed to believe me. It was clockwork after that. Mondays, Dad worked late and we rested. Tuesday nights and Thursday nights, he was at the bar until well after my bedtime. Wednesdays were the worst. Fridays were normally insults, an occasional slap. Weekends, he drank himself to sleep around 4 in the afternoon. But Wednesdays, he'd come up to my room and do his business. I blocked the door. It was a dozen rounds with a belt. If I cried, it was a slap for every tear. But if I was quiet and let his knuckles crack against my jaw and let him pull my short hair, I'd never have to make up stories at school. I was an adventurous boy and no one looked twice when my hands were scraped or had a bruise on my cheek. I lived for 2 years fearing that one night Dad would hit me too hard and I'd end up with the angels. That scared me. One Wednesday I was sitting in the corner when I saw him, a tall man in the corner. At first I thought it was a woman. It looked like a black dress fell from a black face. I realized after a moment that it was a robe, a cloak, but I learned that word years later. I knew what I was looking at. I'd watched TV. I'd read books. I knew what death was supposed to look like. But I couldn't cry. Dad would come in, I'd get the belt, and death would take me away. But for all the pain in my life, I knew that I wanted to live. That night, I fell asleep on the floor, huddled in the corner of the room, with a halo of moonlight coming from the window resting around my feet. Death simply stood in the darkest corner of my room, behind the door leading to the hall. He was there every bad night after, always Wednesdays. Some Fridays when Dad was in his worst moods, every night he got closer. After 2 months, he would sit on the toy box at the end of my bed, sitting with his back against the wall, turned sideways, so I was caught the profile of the shadowy hood. "Why are you here?" I asked him one night. He stared at me from the toy box, knees pressed against his chest and arms curled around his shins, almost a fetal position, though there was no fear in the position, just boredom. "To watch," he told me. I swallowed at those first words. I'd expected a quiet rasp like on TV. Death's voice was something more. It was a burly man's confident and strong. It was a caring mother's nurturing tone, a madman laugh, and a child's giggle. It disturbed and comforted me. "To watch what?" I asked. He simply looked at me. I saw his eyes for the first time that night. I had always expected soulless pits there. Instead, I found blue orbs in a bleached skull. Those orbs held galaxies, eternal and non-existent. Everything and nothing lived in the shadow of his cloak. Those contradictions comforted me. "Over you, child," Death responded. I had thought he lied to me, and I grew upset. I asked him why he never stopped my father. "It is not my place to intervene," he told me. I asked him what he meant. He told me that he couldn't stop my father if he tried. He simply was there to guide me if my nightmare ever came true. After that night, Death was more of a father to me in the way my own never was. The next week, he brought a thick leather-bound book. Within were fairy tales, dark and light themes in countless languages. He told me stories in the voice of my grandmother, who died when I was 4. When I got older, he stopped bringing the book. Stayed up until the crack of dawn talking. I asked him about the afterlife and why things were the way they were. He always answered vaguely, telling me that I'd understand one day. He stayed with me and comforted me until dawn peeked over my neighbor's roof. Then the sunlight would touch his black robe, turning it into blinding white. Then he was gone. He'd be back next week, and I'd get ready for school. I never tired when death spoke to me. Life went on. When I was 12, my doctor fixed my nose for the third time and started asking questions. Within 3 weeks, I was taken from that home and put into an orphanage. In a Hollywood moment, my family doctor, who had heard about what had been happening from a friend at the hospital, adopted me. He and his wife had been trying for a child for years. They never did. I lived a happy life after that. I never forgot what happened to me in my youth, though. I followed in my father's footsteps and became a physician. Sadly, jobs were tight, and I took a role in the morgue. All those years around death helped me work with my new job, and I enjoyed it. My heart broke when my mother was in an accident. I was the one who put the tag on her toe. I had to take the rest of the week off, but death was there that day. He stood in the corner of the storage room when I closed the drawer. Holding his skeletal hand was a little girl with green eyes and chocolate hair. I'd seen my mother's family pictures and knew this was her, around 7 years old. It hurt me, but death nodded to me, and I knew that he would take care of her. In my lifetime, I've closed the drawer on 4 parents. Dad drove into storefront while driving drunk. I had to leave the room when they wheeled him in. I would have spat on his cold husk of a body if I didn't. Mom drank herself into an early grave a year later. I pitied her when I closed the drawer. He had broken her soul, and she died in pain. Though my mother left that morgue the same way my mother did, I still remember the screams when death dragged my father through the door, a red-hot chain and metal collar strapped around his neck. My father, the man that saved my life, died 4 years ago. He went quietly in his sleep. I volunteered to close the drawer on him. When I did, death arrived and took a little boy with dark hair and blue eyes. You may wonder why I'm writing this. In truth, I'm not quite sure myself. I guess what I want to tell people is not to fear death. He's a gentle being with a crappy job, and he saved my life. With the life he gave me, I've married. I've raised 3 children, 2 girls and a boy who look just like their mother. I have 9 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren, with a 3rd one on the way. I lost my wife last year to a heart attack. It hurts me to think about it, but I know she didn't fear death. She knew my story, the one I'm telling you now, and she went in her sleep, holding my hand. As I review these final thoughts, I look to the window. Out there I see a figure in the street, snow blowing, white on black robes. A moment ago I opened the window and invited him in. When you live as long as I have, you learn to treat a guest right. Now he's standing in the corner, patient as the day I met him. Once I am done writing this story, I'm going to turn off my computer, put the little girl he brought with him into my lap, and close my eyes. My wife will close her brilliant blue eyes and rest her crimson locks on my chin. I'll take one breath and fall asleep. When I wake up, I'll be with my family. I'll see my mother and father again. I'll see my mom, happier than she was in life. I'll see the 4 dogs I've had in my lifetime, too, hopefully. Mortimer, death calls from the corner. I sigh and type faster. If I can say one last thing, I'd like to quote Blue Oyster Cult. Don't fear the Reaper, because after all, people are the real monsters. Story number 3. Well, to be fair, I don't know if anything I encountered could be supernatural or not. When you work/study in a museum, you're often exposed to really harsh chemicals that can be very dangerous if not handled very carefully. The place I was at was a dinosaur ice age museum connected to a small community college. I spent my time studying at college and partying and volunteering with the museum a lot. The following are my best memories of things I saw and heard about in the area during that time. So I guess I'll start from the school and work my way up. The school owned a building that used to be the small town's hospital. That was pretty much the only place in town that had the facilities necessary to host an ice age lab. What had been the old morgue had been converted into a paleo lab, and the body freezer was now home to several mammoths, mastodons, and a woolly rhino or two. We had several workbenches where we would take the dinosaur bones that would be gathered from the surrounding desert and clean the rock matrix off of them. We would assemble the bones and glue them together with Paleobond, which I hope is still made because it was the most awesome glue ever, and if needed, put a clear lacquer coat on the bones. We would build armature frames so that other schools and museums could acquire and display the skeletons. It was a lot of fun and a lot of hard work. We used the carts they used to ferry the bodies around the morgue to haul bigger bones like brachiosaur leg bones, and we had a few huge pelvic bones that weighed a couple of 100 pounds. We had a lot of storage space, and lots of large tool chests had been put there, with individual locks on every drawer and door. The shelves were lined with foam rubber to protect the bones. Every now and again, we'd have to inventory the collection, and we'd go get different specimens for the paleontologists to study. One night, when I was there late, I was putting some projects that we'd all been working on into the lockable areas. Since I was the last one there, I had the job of going through the whole storage area and making sure all the drawers were closed, locked, open the deep freezer room to make sure the doors were pressurized, and to smell for decomposition to make sure the temperature hadn't gotten too high for the mammoth carcasses. I'd gone about all my rounds and looked back down the hallway to double check in case one of the drawers was still open. And all of the drawers were open, every single one. It took hours to go through, close, lock, and verify them all. When I was done, I came back out to the main area and I watched the negative pressure sealed doors to the body freezer room open themselves. The doors were big enough that I had to close them to be able to get out of the storage area. When I pushed on them, they swung closed easily. But there was a vacuum system specifically designed to keep the doors locked and sealed to keep the cold in that room. Tools would often go missing, but I always chalked that up to other students being careless with the equipment until tools would start disappearing from your own workstation and no one else was in the building. That I couldn't explain so easily. I never saw anything more strange than that, but several other students and the paleontologists themselves talked about seeing the shadows of people standing at the freezer doors or the outlines of people in the dark corners of the room. As if it happened all the time, several had names, but I had never heard of any of the named ghosts being malicious directly. One student claimed that she had seen several instances of the ghosts trying to trap her in the paleo lab. She described in detail the lab door slamming and locking themselves shut when she was the only one there. After a few moments of that, she could hear whispers and occasionally feel tugs on her clothes. She very suddenly stopped working on dinosaur bones entirely one day and refused to talk about why. But the rest of the building that housed the paleo lab was also used for classrooms by the college, and we noticed, commented, and asked about why she wouldn't sign up for classes in the building. She wouldn't even give us a verbal response. She'd just shut up and leave the room. The museum itself had some strangeness to it as well. I heard about a lot of different things happening there. The museum was one of the only museums in the world to have several full sets of paleo Native American clothes, not just a scrap or two. We're talking 10,000 plus year olds. From time to time, they would dress a mannequin in one of the sets of clothes and put them on display to the public. That would usually be when the stories would start. Visitors would start asking why we had actors and regalia hanging around the museum when we didn't. Volunteer staff would report seeing an Indian chief, as they put it, wandering around the Hall of Man. The building was very well made, but when the clothes were on display, power fluctuations would happen. The staff, including myself, that had been around the most, wouldn't talk about the stories of the place, knowing that people will see what they want to see, hoping that no one would see anything. But someone always did. The only thing I ever came close to calling paranormal was after I'd been helping with a new display that involved a lot of spray paint and glue. I left the work area to go get some paint and walk through the connecting area and the Hall of Dinosaurs to the Hall of Man to get to our storage room, which was separate from the Paleo Lab building, and saw several figures standing in the middle of the room. When I walked in, it seemed like they looked at me and screamed, but there was no sound. Then they began to elongate and stretch like pulled black smoke and disappeared. I figured it was a hallucination from too many spray paint fumes, but others who had clear heads reported similar cases elsewhere in the museum too. Often in the Hall of Dinosaurs, where no light coming from the Hall of Man was, we'd get reports of a Native American dressed person being seen in the reflections of the glass display cabinets, only for no one to be there when the person turned around. One woman I knew who was very good friends with many of the professors was convinced the entire area was close to some kind of gateway or portal to somewhere not so nice. But I figured she was kind of a hippie and probably a little too into the New Age spirit seeing seen in the area. Okay, so there's the kind of place the college was. So now, we'd go out on an expedition to look for dinosaur bones, and we were always warned to keep a gallon of water with ourselves at all times. The desert there is extremely harsh, one of the worst in the world. During the summer heat, stroke and dehydration were serious issues and the two most common killers by far. They would bring several times more water in big storage trucks than we actually needed to drink. We used some to make plaster jackets for the bones we were digging, but the rest was used to towel ourselves down to cool off in the midday heat. The night was exact opposite, and we all had below zero gear for sleeping. Exposure was a real threat at all times. If anyone was seeing things, they immediately had to report it and take a break. I just thought that meant dehydration or heat hallucination, but things started to happen a lot. The first things we started seeing were shadows on the horizon. When these would be spotted, the paleontologists would try to get us to work so hard and fast as we could, and never failed when we saw those shadows. Black market looters would roll into the area they figured we were and try to loot whatever they could. Bones were good, but archaeological finds were the best. And if we pack up and moved to some other place from where we were digging, we'd get raided at night. The poachers were always heavily armed, and we shoot at anything they thought moved. We didn't set lookouts one day and didn't catch the shadows on the horizon. We cooked up dinner at the end of the day, showered or sponge clean, and packed up for the night to go to sleep, only to wake up in the middle of the night to hearing gunfire and for a couple of bullets to hit one of the water trucks and punch a few holes in one of the tanks. We scrambled to pack up and abandon the dig. Most of the time, nothing would be taken because black market buyers wanted intact bones and skulls. Most of what we were collecting had broken in the decomposition fossilization processes and wasn't really recognizable to the untrained. We would hear random screams that sounded like someone being murdered. We figured it was probably mountain lions that had wandered down out of the mountains, but after a while screams started coming closer to the dig sites. The leaders and paleontologists would start getting nervous and making sure everyone was huddled around the inside boundaries of the digs. I figured it was just to keep coyotes and mountain lions away from stray volunteers who would get hurt. Besides looters, nighttime had other terrors, though. Massive centipedes, field mice, and rats that could potentially carry the black plague, and ticks that could give you Lyme disease. We had to check each other for ticks at the end of every day. If we'd seen a lot of skunks, coyotes, a couple of hundred meters from camp, we'd have to check each other at every meal. It's amazing how fast you get used to being naked around people you've never met before. The first time someone turns up with a tick on them, and the Forest Service EMT that is assigned to your dig site has to remove the tick and administer whatever it is that they can to prevent Lyme disease. Male, female, gay, straight, doesn't matter. Look at my ass all you want. I don't want Lyme disease. But when the sun went down, life started crawling out of every nook and cranny in the desert. If you shined a flashlight around the outside edge of the site, you'd see the reflections of light from thousands of nocturnal eyes looking your way. mostly spiders and tarantulas, but it was pretty common to see desert foxes, coyotes, skunks, lizards, and rattlesnakes. There was a strict rule of the buddy system at night. Even if you had to go to the bathroom, your buddy would get up at night to go sit next to you in the two-wide porta-potty while you pooped, and you for them. From time to time, though, the animal sounds would just cut out. The desert would go completely silent. Usually, one of the paleontologists would get on a loudspeaker and state that everyone was to stay in their tents at all times. No one was to go outside for any reason until the animals started making noise again. One fellow who'd been volunteering for years told us, including the paleontologist, that he'd been hiking out in the desert decades before and had lost track of time. Easy to do in the desert heat. He'd gotten caught out in some of the bare rock areas without a sleeping bag or tent. He started gathering up what little materials there was to make some semi-warm bedding for himself to bed down for the night and started to get comfortable. He woke up in the middle of the night when he realized that the desert around him was totally and completely silent. He started looking around but couldn't see far, so he scrapped together some dry grass and an old branch or two that he could scavenge and lit a fire with his lighter. He said that a bunch of hunched, human-like creatures with pale skin and very thin, sort of starved-looking, scampered away from the firelight. He described them as having longer arms than us and kind of walk hopping on all fours. Their heads were human, but the skin was pulled tight, and there were sores all over their hairless bodies. He gathered materials to keep the fire going all night and stayed awake. He didn't see them all night, but the moment he started nodding off to sleep, he'd hear scampering noises and wake up to see the feet of one or more scrambling away from the firelight, back to where he couldn't see. He stayed up all night like that and was able to make it back to his car by morning. There was no known bears in the area or large mammals of any kind with the exception of the random lost mountain lion or mustang. But on the nights where the desert went silent, we would wake up to find the nozzles for the water trucks had been tampered with and small footprints that looked kind of human all over the campsites. Another danger was the archaeological sites. They were paleo-native Kiva cities scattered around the desert. The area had been a grasslands as little as 500 or so years ago, and different peoples from different areas had settled there, paleo-natives and Anasazi mostly. The problem was that their buildings were either cliff-dwelling or kivas on the ground. The villages were small enough that it was pretty easy to tell that those people were still part of nature and not free from the food chain. Their kivas were dug into the tops of small hills, and wooden logs were assembled on their tops with woven grasses, then covered with dirt, and they sometimes even planted bushes or trees on or near them to camouflage them. You never knew what was a hill and what wasn't. I was out scouting with one of the paleontologists outside of a dig site and left his side for a moment because I really had to pee. I went to get to the other side of the hill we were standing next to get some privacy, and when I got to the top of the hill, it collapsed under me. I fell about 9 feet and sprained both of my ankles and knees pretty badly coming down. I'm lucky I didn't break anything. It was pitch black and dusty inside. I started coughing immediately. The paleontologist climbed to the top as quickly and carefully as he could and shouted down to me not to move, but most importantly, to stay in the light at all costs. He radioed into the rest of the group to get rope and help, and the dig teams rushed over to rescue me. After my ears stopped ringing from the fall, I realized I could hear the paleontologist screaming at me to stand up to get my whole body in the light. I pulled my arms and legs in closer to me, and I was hurting a lot until I heard something scurry in the dark. I'd been around mice and rats, badgers and skunks, and other small animals before. I knew what they sounded like. This sounded significantly bigger. I got a huge dump of adrenaline and pulled myself to my feet as fast as I could and stood in the middle of the sunlight coming in through the hole my body had made in the ceiling. I could hear breathing and heavy flesh on rock slapping in the dark. It felt like hours, but in just a few minutes the others had arrived and lowered a rope for me. I tied myself a climber seat and they hauled me out. when the lead paleontologist was there to help me get free. They had the most experienced people there waiting to be lowered into the kiva. While the EMT was looking me over, the paleontologist said, "Do you think there's any good items to be found down there?" He was really excited. "There was something down there with me," I kind of half shouted. "It's not safe." He became very stern and got very close to me and said, "Listen, there was nothing down there with you. It's safe." I started to protest, but he said, "Those guys are professionals. It's safe. You're safe. We're safe. Do you understand?" I just nodded and let the EMT work. After a few minutes, they lowered one of the archaeologists who had come with us down in the kiva. We heard a gunshot a few minutes later and heard the archaeologist shout, "It's okay, it's okay. It's just a desert rat." Desert rats only get about a foot long in that part of the country, and what was in there was significantly bigger. Normally, when we stumbled across kivas, the archaeologists would have everyone help out with the materials they needed to collect, whatever they could find in the huts. But this time, only the most seasoned staff went in, and no one was allowed near the entrance overnight. I'd heard the term desert rat a lot from Forest Service personnel, and from the museum volunteer staff, it definitely means something else. There's more from the area, but I've got things to do, so I'm going to get back to them. If this gets some attention, I may write some more up and maybe answer some questions, which I know you have.